one or two of these gentlemen have to get back very soon. To my left, Jerry Griffin, who's been handling the flight director's duties again today. Next to him, Charlie Duke, the CAPCOM, and Jack Schmidt, who will answer questions about geology. And Phil Schaffer, the flight dynamics officer on this shift. Jack Schmidt would like to get back to the control center very soon. He wants to be there in time for the landmark tracking. So we would ask immediately after Jerry's summation that if you have any questions to direct to Jack Schmidt, do it at that time so he can leave. Jerry?
Okay. We came on today at around 71 hours and 30 minutes. Everything was pretty much as planned up to that time, and I guess I could summarize the entire day's activities with saying that, by saying that they're completely normal, and we've certainly been satisfied with the way the spacecraft and the crew have performed today. We just saw the TV, I'm sure as you did, and I think those are some of the most fantastic shots that that I'll ever see. We had little problem today. In fact, the only thing that I can think of is we had one ground configuration problem where it took us some time to get some commands in. Other than that, we ran pretty much completely by the timeline, completely by the flight plan, and did pretty much exactly what we wanted to. Let me point out that we did have, as you probably copied in the air-to-ground, we did have the primary evaporator dry out on us on the second rev in lunar orbit. We closed the back pressure valve, which essentially shuts that system down, and we intend to stay in lunar orbit with that primary evaporator not supplying any cooling and letting the radiators handle it. Now, the shift that's on duty now will be watching that over the next couple of revs to make sure that that's all okay, and we suspect that it will be, and we'll probably just sleep tonight with the primary evaporator shut down. I'm going to let, if you have questions about what the velocities were of the two burns that we did today and what kind of resultant orbits we had, I'll let Phil answer those questions. He's got all of that data. I don't really think there's too much other to cover. I think most of it's in the air-to-ground transcript, and I think we ought to, in the interest of saving some time here, get on with the questions, unless some of these guys have something they want to add to it. Why don't we go on to questions?
Yeah, and let's get the ones that have. Does anybody have any questions for Jack Schmidt, because we want to get him out of here? Okay, let's start right here. Let's hold.
Okay, here's the question. Are you surprised by the volcanoes that Stafford, Cernan, and Young reported seeing? And what about the comment that some of those craters glow as if they were radioactive? Do you think they possibly could be?
Well, I think as far as volcanoes, I'm sure Tom and Gene and John, all three of them, are describing what we have talked about, a type of feature we've talked about in the training. Apollo 8 got some rather striking photographs of some cones with high craters in them with dark interiors, and what they apparently are seeing are some more of these type of feature, which is very similar to a volcano, and apparently they've seen some additional features on them that make it even more striking appearance of volcanic origin. I'm not sure exactly where they were seeing these. A likely place, we'll find out later, but a likely place is the large basin on the backside. I believe it's called number 9 in the international, by the International Committee on Nomenclature.
Well, latitude and longitude, so we can pick it up on the map.
I'm just speculating, but it's on the map, and this is a likely place. It's a basin similar to the one that Apollo 8 flew over, and it's a likely place for them. We'll know more about that later, so I wouldn't jump to conclusions on it. Of course, there's been abundant evidence for some time that both volcanism and impact processes are operating on the moon, among probably many other kinds of processes. The big question that we're trying to answer is, best we can within the context of a test flight program, what are the relative proportions of volcanism and impact? Certainly the dominant feature on this sculpturing the surface is impact, but we're pretty sure, and this is just more evidence that volcanism is an important process. The radioactivity bit, I think, is just a dominant feature on this sculpturing the surface is impact, but we're pretty sure, and this is just more evidence that volcanism is an important process. The radioactivity bit, I think, is just a normal description of a appearance of something glowing. There's certainly no necessary implication that there's a radioactive area. The glow is a contrast between the dark interior of a crater and the brightly lit central peak, and that's something you guys saw on the TV today, and it was apparent in Tsiolkovsky on Apollo 8 in some of the pictures. So I wouldn't attribute that to radioactivity. That was it's just a descriptive term.
Would you attribute it to a transient event, the glow, or just the natural, as you previously described it?
It's not a transient event, unless I'm very sorely mistaken. It's just it's the contrast of a slope getting near or approaching zero phase, a high retroreflectance that the moon has, with the other parts of the craters that are at high phase angle. And as some of you know, looked at the moon's photometric function, this is what you'd expect to see.
Three simple questions. One, did it strike you that their description tonight, and including some of the TV maybe, seemed somewhat different than Apollo 8?
No, I think their descriptions reflect a greater amount of training by all three crewmen in looking and working with the orbital track that they've had, that they're flying over. We've talked a lot about the possibilities of things they'll see. For example, when we asked them about more descriptive work on the rills, they came back with no sign of buildups on the edges, and this was one of the possibilities we have discussed. We try not in the training to come up with any clear-cut answer that this crater is volcanic or impact or water-worn or what have you. We're just trying to be as objective as we can, and I think that you'll find their descriptions are remarkably objective.
Sort of to follow that, it's my understanding that you've probably spent as much or more time going over these photographs and things as anybody, and I wonder, did it look like you thought it would, and what were you thinking when you were sitting there tonight watching those television pictures?
Well, I can't claim to have spent as much time with the photographs as anybody. As far as the onboard data is concerned, I probably have. There's certainly plenty of people that are working full-time on lunar photogeology, where it's sort of a part-time task with me, extracurricular almost.
I have two questions. The first is, how do you interpret the report? I think it was Gene Cernan, who thought he saw ashes in one of these calderas that he was looking at. And
one of these what?
These are calderas that he's describing.
I don't know where that he's used the term caldera.
He didn't use the term, but this is what it.
Caldera is a very specific type of volcanic crater. What they are seeing and the descriptions I've heard are more akin to. For those of you that are interested, to a composite volcano with a central crater in the peak part of it. This is what we've seen a little bit before.
I'm not saying
there aren't calderas on the moon, but what they're talking about is
these are not calderas or calderas, then, in your opinion.
What's that?
These are not calderas or calderas, in your opinion.
I'm not hearing you very well in terms of your terminology. What we're looking at are composite volcanoes. If they are volcanoes, that type of feature would be normally called a composite or a shield volcano or a cone, volcanic cone. A caldera or a cauldron are two different things.
Okay. What about the ashes? Are there how do you interpret
that? I again missed that term. The term ash or cinders is a common expression and a common type of material, geologically speaking, around these kind of volcanoes. The darkening of the interiors, the dark interiors and the dark rims, which they also mentioned, and which we also saw in Apollo 8 photograph, is typical of volcanic cones and relatively recent eruptions. Now, what relatively means in terms of years, I'm not willing to say, but it's apparently the inside and the rims of these craters are still dark relative to other parts of them, which have lightened with time, apparently.
The second part of the question is, would there be any possibility that the illuminated object that they report, instead of being radioactive, might have been some form of outgassing, as in Aristarchus?
As I said before, the normal explanation, and I think that's all we can go on, what you'd likely expect, what we've seen before, is that it's just a characteristic of the lunar photometric function, and where you get bright or strong contrast as a function of slope. And in the case of Central Peak, you have a steep slope, and in that particular orientation to the sun, that was giving you a bright Central Peak. He could have said bright, and there would have been no great discussion about it. He said it. But the contrast made it appear as if it glowed. I'm not saying it isn't some kind of glowing, because I didn't see it. But the logical and simple explanation is the other.
Jack, I have two questions. First, it seems that when you look at the moon through a continuously transmitting television camera of this type, and it's shifting, you get a substantially greater feel for the texture of the ground from a continually changing angle than you do from the stepped type photography and some of the other motion pictures that have been taken. And I'm wondering whether or not you have an opinion on putting this type of camera system into an unmanned satellite and doing a complete high resolution, high magnification photo reconnaissance of the moon.
Well, if you earlier in the space program had decided to do this, I think it would have been, and eventually we essentially started to do it with the Ranger system, which was an excellent camera system, and we got excellent detail from it. The difficulty in a small satellite of getting bandwidth that will carry this kind of resolution, or Ranger kind of resolution in continuous strips, is quite great. Now, what we've got now, we've got reconnaissance photography of a large part of the moon with the orbiter system, and to plan to fly a satellite just to do this with a TV camera, I think, would take some soul searching at this stage of the game. But you did get an illustration of how much greater your overall interpretive capability and resolution, really, of features with a continuous view like a man has versus the step view that a normal picture taking gives you. This capability is much, much greater. It makes a great big a great deal of difference.
I was away for part of the earlier space-to-ground communication. Has there been any statement that would provide a basis for comparing the 8 crew's appraisal of the black and white or plaster of Paris color and texture to the impression that this crew has? You know, we're very deceived by the color distortion of the 3 filter system. Sometimes the screen looks pinkish, sometimes it looks bluish. It depends on how the lighting is and so on. And have you asked the crew anything that would give you a calibration on how believable any of the colors are that we see?
Well, just at the last transmission, we got them to give us a picture of the color chart, and to my lay eye in this case, it looked like they were getting excellent representation, that the ground had established the right color balance. The crew's statement on color, statements and moderately well concurred in by all three, is that it's a brownish gray. And this is the same impression that the 8 crew had, at least in their photo debriefing, and when they discussed the pictures, the color pictures. They said the black and white pictures gave a better representation of lunar color with the exception of a little brown tinge they'd like to see in it. And so I think the two stories are entirely consistent.
Were you startled at all by anything that the crew said or that you saw on the television? Was there any detail that didn't seem to conform with what you expected?
Well, I can't... I think it did startle me in a sense to hear their fairly vivid descriptions, and we've also listened a little bit more on the backside tapes of these volcanic features that appear like volcanoes to them. I wasn't really expecting a fairly clear-cut observation like that this early, because it was this is the operational part of the mission, and so I guess you might say I was startled with that. As far as the given kind of features, one thing else that I'm quite surprised at, and I think though there probably are seen boulders in these craters from 60 nautical miles. They're just some pretty large slide areas anyway, large masses that are in and around some of these relatively fresh craters. That is a very interesting observation.
I think he was using the monocular when he saw the boulders. He wasn't seeing those with the naked eye.
No, but that's just an 8-power monocular, and it corresponds with Bill Anders' only observation of boulders in the crater Tsiolkovsky, which he saw some that had apparently rolled out on from the central peak out onto the floor. So, again, we're getting fairly consistent observations there, but I'll have to go back and look at it, or you can look at the transcripts, but I believe that Gene did at one time say he thought he picked them up as a different in texture with a naked eye. And Bill Anders said the same thing. So the eye is almost resolving boulders, and the eye is doing a fantastic job, no question about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm having a little problem orienting some of the things I saw through the television camera. We talked about the brownish-gray appearance of the moon, yet out one set of windows it appeared quite gray, and on the other side almost reddish brown. Now, this was a function of the way the light was hitting the lunar surface from...
I noticed that too. In the early TV pass, the screen appeared more gray than when they switched over and got part of the night sky, or the part of the sky in the picture. And I really don't know the answer to that. I'd be interested to hear the answer to that one myself. It did, I don't know whether you agree, Charlie, but nobody commented on it at the time, but I did notice a distinct change in hue.
And this seemed to change from window to window whenever they were passing it from one side to the other.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the light levels the camera was seeing was making it difficult for the ground to stay locked onto what they thought was good color.
Ah, so the color differences we saw were perhaps more a function of what the ground mixers were doing.
They're definitely a function of what the ground is doing to try to make them good pictures, but I think they have a number of controls that you'll have to talk to Paul Cohen or somebody like that about. But at the end, when they did show the color chart, and after seeing a lot of brownish-gray moon, at least on our color monitor, the color chart came out real well, and I suspect that that was a pretty close representation of what they were seeing.
Thank you.
The appearance of the landing site?
Well, I'd like to see it a little closer up, but it looked like we've seen it before pretty much. Again, when you get very low sun angles on these landing sites, they start to look a little bit rougher and rougher, and it's getting more and more, in my eye anyway, that you're going to have a real piloting job when you get down close. But so far, I don't think we see anything we didn't really know we were taking on when we decided to land there.
I think that takes care of my question,
Doc.
Okay.
To the right of the landing site, I think it was, there was what appeared to be a number of high ridges, almost a mountain range. How far away is this from the landing site itself?
Those to the south, it's the area, the northern Pyrenees there, I believe is what you're talking about. And as I recall, they're on the order of 30, 40 nautical miles south of the landing site 1 now. We haven't had a good look yet of landing site 2, but the same comment would apply. There are relatively high highland areas to the south of landing site 2 and landing site 1.
Range of error?
The current estimation of our guidance error for limb targeting for the landing, neglecting the piloted side of it, is on the order of 10 nautical miles by 4 nautical miles. So we're 10 long by 4 wide. So those are not of any consequence to the landing at all.
Did I understand you to say that we had not had a look at landing site 2 yet?
Well, we just got a bare glimpse of it. They were showing you the crater Mulkey, which is just south of landing site 2.
Well, it seemed to me...
It's south and east of landing site 2. And landing site 2 and the television shots was just still pretty close to the terminator, and they were having trouble getting it because of sun shafting and everything like this.
This is what impelled you to say that you wouldn't want to draw any conclusions about the roughness or smoothness of landing site 2 based on this very low sun angle. Is that correct?
Well, I think we've drawn our conclusions on the landing sites. There's been extensive analysis prior to this mission of the relative roughness of the different parts of the moon, and we selected Landing Site 2 as one place that we're willing to commit to a landing on. What I think we see at these low sun angles that we haven't seen before, and some of the Apollo 8 photography showed this in Landing Site 1, is that you start to see very subtle differences in slope. You start putting a 1 degree or half degree sun on a surface, and you see fantastic detail that you never knew was there, and that would apply to this rug as well as it does to a landing site. And but these are relatively low features that you're picking up, and they start to look very striking at low sun angles. But I don't think there's any reason to suspect that we have any greater problem than we had before.
Go ahead, right here.
In your opinion as a geologist, have they broken any new geological ground, particularly with reference to the volcanoes? Do you feel their observations fairly well established that some of these craters are of volcanic origin?
I think that, in my own personal feeling, that question has been established for some time. You won't know without fear of contradiction until you sample and start looking at some of the textures of the rocks that the Apollo 11 crew hopefully brings back. I think that the new ground that this crew is breaking and all, in conjunction with the Apollo 8 crew is two things. From the pure lunar science point of view, we're getting more and more information, again, on the relative amount of volcanism versus impact. For those of if you're willing to take my interpretation on what volcanism and impact is. The other side of it is, again, we're proving step by step here that we've got the glassware, if you will, that we can perform the experiment with. And of course, anytime we get another step of this test flight program out of the way, we've got another bit of that glassware to eventually do some really fine science on the moon.
Following the same thought, do you think that 50,000 foot pass is going to give them a lock-in, perhaps, that we haven't had before on some of these questions that are still open?
I suspect that the 50,000-foot pass for a few of the features that they've already commented on and some others that we selected with some crazy names, but mainly the use of these names is to seat them in your memory of what you're looking for. For example, the two rills that we've talked about. They've already made, I think, a very significant observation on the sinuous rills that we see on that track and that they'll be getting much closer to, and that is that at the very low sun angles they were not detecting any buildup on the edges of these rills, which is one more piece of data that you have to filter into put into the hopper to interpret them. They have another excellent chance to confirm this observation as they get down at 50,000 feet. Plus, just they have a higher sun angle, they'll be able to see into these things better at that time and from a much closer vantage point.
Your own opinion of what the rills are?
Well, there are several possibilities, and the only thing that I feel is that when all the air is cleared, it'll turn out that they're rills and they're rills, and that they're formed by a combination of processes. This is usually the way it happens in geology, in spite of everybody taking firm stands one side or the other.
Ready?
Jack, if they had a chance yet to look at the rill where Apollo 8 reported seeing a buildup on the side, a levee, you call it, the other day?
I must have missed that in Apollo 8 or forgotten it. I'm not sure.
There was a picture from Apollo 8 right fairly late in the mission, that right toward the terminator, and a picture of a rill where there appeared to be a buildup on the side of it, like a levee.
I did have the impression on one of the late Apollo 8 pictures of this same rill that they're looking at, Diamondback, that in the very low sun angle, very late in Apollo 8, it looked like there was a buildup on the side of it. But they were not able to confirm this, and I suspect their observation is much better than the one we had from those very, very low sun angle pictures. So they're much closer to it, for one thing.
Would you explain what you mean by build up on the side of the rill?
Well, if any of you have ever been in the mountains and seen the track of, in the Sierras, for example, track of a mud flow that's come down a fairly steep slope, it's not confined to the mountains, but this is the best place to see it. You'll see a channel, and then on either side of the channel, there'll be a little levee. And you can watch these things when they're happening. You get a mud flow or during a rainstorm, and what's happening, the velocity is high enough, and the turbulence in the flow is high enough that it's kicking material out to the side. So what if these sinuous rills do have an origin by some alluvial process, that is erosive process, this was one of the things you might have expected to see by certain kinds of these processes. So far, they're saying that they didn't see it, and this does tend to narrow the possibilities.
Does the crew have instructions from you to look for these indications of erosion in the rills when they go down to the low altitude tomorrow?
Well, I don't have any real instructions to the crew, but the emphasis of what we're trying to do is come back with as objective set of observations as we can. And one of the best ways to do that is to think about the possibilities of origin so that you're thinking of what kinds of things would indicate various kinds of origin. And so from the erosive standpoint of origin of these rills, they've been briefed on the kinds of things that erosive origin might leave as traces. One of these things were these levees, which they've already talked about.
What kinds of cameras will be used, if there's more than one, tomorrow for the two low passes? And will these be triggered automatically? Will they be sequence cameras?
We have one sequence camera with an 18-millimeter lens on it. It's a standard sequence camera we've been using in the Apollo program.
Which one is that?
That's the Maurer.
Maurer
camera, 16-millimeter camera with an 18-millimeter lens. And that'll be taking a sequence photography out the right-hand window, and Tom primarily, but shared with Gene, will be using an electric Hasselblad with an 80-millimeter lens out the left-hand window. And the sequence camera photography will be color, and the Hasselblad will be black and white primarily.
As you watched that television picture, these pictures of the moon, did any of the terrain strike you as familiar with any parts of the Earth?
Well, I think the impact craters look like impact craters we've seen on Earth. Probably the most unusual style, type of feature that we saw today are the sinuous rills and the Maury ridges. These are not awfully common, at least at this scale on Earth. I don't know of any good examples of them. The main thing that I think to keep in mind about the moon is the chances of there being planetary processes of which we are unfamiliar are relatively small. What we're seeing is a difference in the relative proportion of these processes having acted and in their effect because of a different gravitational and atmospheric and hydrospheric environment. That's a little complex, but really most so far the history of the space program and with respect to the moon has shown that we're seeing old friends, we're just seeing them in different proportions.
Do you not agree that some of those high mountain ranges we saw might look the same from a high-flying aircraft looking down over the Earth?
The main difference between most terrestrial mountain ranges, other than the fact they're covered by vegetation and snow, would be the degree of sharpness. Most, at least the Sierras, the Rocky Mountains, are generally much sharper than the lunar mountains. The characteristic thing about the high terrain in the moon is it's very subdued, it's rounded. It may be high, but there are no sharp corners. And because of the types of weathering processes operating on the Earth, namely wind and rain and ice compared to meteor impact bombardment on the moon, we're getting that different kind of surficial characteristic. Is that clear?
Two things. One, when the camera was at full zoom and you got a full screen picture, how large an area were we seeing?
You mean a minimum zoom, 12.5 millimeters, I think it is? I'd have to guess offhand. I think, let me take a look here. We did look at the area that John's going to do some landmark tracking in a little while, around F1. We probably were...